They tell a story about a couple that was sitting in the middle of a night, I guess watching some show, when a burglar breaks into the home and points his gun at the woman. "Tell me your name." She's trembling. She's gripped by fear. "I'm an innocent human being. What do you want from me? Tell me your name right now." Trembling, she says, "My name is Elizabeth." And the burglar tells her, "This is your lucky night. I was about to shoot your brains out, but my mother's name was Elizabeth. How can I kill somebody who carries my beloved mother's name? Your life is spared." He takes his gun and he points it at the husband. "What is your name?" The man, well aware of what is coming, begins to plead for his life. But the thief would not listen. "Tell me your name right now or I kill you this moment." He looks at him and he says, "My name is Harry, but they call me Elizabeth." And I say this as an opening to the theme I want to discuss presently, which is I was asked to take a concept or a story and try to analyze it or demonstrate its perspective from the viewpoint of Jewish mysticism, from the viewpoint of the Kabbalah, and from the viewpoint of Hasidism, of Hasidus. The story I want to reflect upon is a quite well-known story in the Bible, in Genesis. And it's in the weekly Torah portion. But first, I want to analyze it from the literal perspective so that we can then appreciate the contribution of Hasidism or mysticism in this story. It's the moment when we're introduced to a new character in the genesis of Jewish history whose name is Tamar. Judah, who was the chief son of Jacob, responsible for the selling of his brother Joseph into Egyptian slavery, left the family, relocated to another location, married, had three sons, Er, Onan, and Shelah, and he married off his oldest son, Er, to a woman named Tamar. Er, the Torah says, sinned before God. He died prematurely. Judah, well aware of the tradition of Yibum, of Levirate marriage, marries off his second son, Onan, to Tamar, to the widow of his first son. We all know in Deuteronomy there is the mitzvah called Yibum, where the Bible states, if there are two brothers, and one of them marries, and he dies without children, so there is a mitzvah that his wife, the widow, marry one of his existing brothers, and the child that is born from the second marriage is called on the name of the father, giving a legacy and a remnant of the father who died without children in a living child. This is, of course, if they both want. If the widow wants to marry her brother-in-law and if he wants to marry her. If not, there is a performance called chalitza, which severs the contact, and they both move on to the lives they want to choose for themselves in the future. In fact, since Talmudic times, around 1500 years ago, in Ashkenazi communities and in many Sephardic communities, chalitza has been practiced instead of yibum. Judah was very well aware of this mitzvah, although the Torah has not been given at the time. So he suggests that Tamar, the widow of his first boy, son, who died without children, marries the second son, Onan. Tragedy strikes again, and Onan also dies prematurely. Of course, according to the laws of Yibum, of levirate marriage, she should now marry the third son, Shelah. But Judah, Yehuda, is afraid. He's afraid that his third son will die too with this woman. So what does he do? He procrastinates. He tells her, let's wait. Let's wait till Shelah grows up. Really, he's very scared to give her Shelah, his third son. But he doesn't say no. He says, let's wait. Shelah grows up. She's there. And she sees that Yehuda is not giving her Shelah. So she's stuck. On one end, she can't go and marry anybody else because she's bound to Shelah according to the custom of Yibum. On the other hand, her father-in-law refuses to allow her to marry Shelah. What does one do? So she contrives a courageous strategy in which she undons the garments that she wore as a widow. She dresses very differently, knowing that Judah is on the way to shear his sheep. She positions herself on the road. Yehuda sees her. He does not recognize her. She invites him into a relationship. He takes on the invitation. Vayachshevel a zona. He doesn't know this is his daughter-in-law Tamar. He thinks she's a zona, a harlot. They begin to negotiate a price. He offers a price. But Tamar, at this moment, says, fine, but I need a pledge. I need collateral. And he gives her three things. His cord, his tunic, his staff, his seal, his tunic, his staff. And they enjoy a relationship, and Yehuda moves on. When he sends his friend to pay back the pledge and take the collateral, she's not to be found. Yehuda says, let's not pursue this, so we should not turn out to be laughing stock in the eyes of this neighborhood, of this community. Of course, 3 months later, it is appearing that Tamar is pregnant. How? Shelah was kept away from her, so it couldn't be from him. This means she committed adultery. She was bound in a union to Shelah, in a Yibum union. There was no chalitza, and she betrayed that bond. News comes forth to Yehuda, capital punishment, let her be burnt. At this moment, we appreciate the subtlety and the brilliance of Tamar's strategy. On the way to the fireplace, to the blaze, she sends to Yehuda the three items that he has given her as collateral when they had a relationship, and she says, "Le'isha she'ela lo yanochi hara." To the man whom these items belong to, I am pregnant. He is the father of these children. She achieves two things. First of all, she declares her innocence. This was a relationship with Yehuda. As Nachmanides, as Ramban points out, there was a difference in levirate marriage before the Torah was given and after. After the Torah was given, levirate marriage relates only to brothers-in-law. The widow can marry her husband's brother, any of the brothers. Before the Mosaic law was given, levirate marriage related to any member of the family, which means she could marry not only a brother-in-law, but also a father-in-law. This is what the Ramban, Nachmanides, points out on the verse in the portion. Others say it, the Chizkuni as well, the Medrash already says it. So two things Tamar accomplishes. First of all, she demonstrates to Judah, to Yehuda, that this was totally legal and moral. It was a relationship with him. What is more important, she conveys the message without putting him to shame, without embarrassing him. Nobody else would know that Yehuda is the father. Nobody else would be aware that it was he who had the relationship with her. The only one who knows it is she, and now he. Because only he can recognize these items, the collateral that he gave her. He is the only person aware of the truth. Vayakir Yehuda, Yehuda recognizes it. Vayomer, and he says, Tzotka, she's right, mimeni. It was me. I am the father of these children. And she gives birth to the twins, Peretz, Zarach, which ultimately, as we know, Peretz will father and become the great-great-grandfather of King David, of Yishai, of Boaz, and then Oved, and Yishai, and King David, and the entire Davidic dynasty till Mashiach. That's the story. That's the literal interpretation of the story. Of course, the sages, in the realm of Drash and Remez, see deeper layers in this story that make us appreciate its relevance in a far more profound fashion. As you know, in the Torah there are four layers: Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod, which means any verse, any story, any law can be appreciated on four different levels. We can understand it from its literal perspective. We can appreciate it from a homiletical point of view. We can expound on it and derive various ideas from it. And finally, there is the mystical interpretation. The literal story you've just heard. Now there is a lovely remez, a lovely idea intimated from this story. The Talmud tells us, from this we learn, a person should rather cast himself into a burning furnace rather than embarrass a human being publicly. Tamar could have said, Yehuda, stop hacking a chaynik. Stop being more religious than the Pope and telling me to be burnt when you did it. She didn't embarrass him. From here, the sages understood that psychological abuse can be far more painful and damaging than physical abuse. Embarrassing a human being verbally can have far more damaging effects than any other form of damage. Which reminds me of two short episodes, which the moral tale, the moral ramifications of this are very powerful. One occurred one Friday night at a Shabbaton. I was giving a lecture later in the night, so Friday night I ate with a particular family. The man starts making kiddush, picks up the cup of wine to make kiddush, and the challah, heaven forbid, don't jump out of your seats, was uncovered. Oy gevalt. Of course, who does he blame? Who do good Jewish men blame? His wife. So he turns to his wife. Why didn't you cover the challah? Why didn't you cover the challah? Don't you know Shabbos, you have to cover the challah? Oh, the challah is not covered. Kiddush, the challah is exposed. And you know, when people start screaming and hollering, the hollering itself gets them even more angry. And especially when she gave him this look like, I think it's, you really need help. So he got even more outraged. It was just a look. He got even more outraged because it wasn't even fulfilling its objective of actually putting her down. So he got even more outraged, and it was an ugly scene. After Kiddush, I approach him, ask you a question, of course. Do you know why we cover the challah? Do you have any idea why we cover the challah when we make kiddush? I don't know, but that's the law, and she didn't obey the law like many other laws she doesn't obey. Say, well, one second, one thing at a time. Do you know why we cover the challah Shabbos when we make kiddush? I don't know. What's the difference? You have to follow the law. He was very, very pious, apparently. I said, you're such a pious and holy religious Jew. Why don't you learn some ideas about Judaism? You know, to be pious, it's good to be learned a little bit. So you know what to be pious about and what not to be pious about. So I'll tell you the reason. The Talmud discusses it in the 10th chapter of Tractate Psachim. So the reason is this. In Jewish law, there is order. There is systems. Generally, during the week, if you're eating bread and drinking wine, precedence is given to bread. You first make the blessing over the bread. Hamotzi is the first blessing, the most prominent one. It comes first. It's the Kohen of blessings. On Shabbos, you can't do that because you can't eat before Kiddush. So you have to make Kiddush and then eat. The problem is when you make Kiddush, the bread might feel embarrassed. It might feel ashamed. Oh, what happened to me? I'm being expelled. So we cover the bread, in the words of the sages, Shalayire Bushtoi. The bread should not experience its shame. But now I want to ask you a question. On the line to your therapist or psychoanalyst, have you ever met a piece of challah? And when you ask the challah, why are you going to therapy? The challah said, was haste? 22 years of weekly abuse. 22 years. The wine is always first. Kiddush, this wine, that wine. Me, garnished. What am I, chopped liver? Do you know how that Shabbos table shattered my self-confidence? Do you know how that Shabbos table destroyed my self-image? Do you know I can't date normally? I got on a shidduch. I can't develop normal relationships. I can't have friends. I'm always knocking myself. I have all these stereotypes and complexities. I'm here in therapy for that. On the line to my therapist, I never saw challah or bread. You know why? Challah doesn't have these problems. Baruch Hashem, good for it. Doesn't have these problems. Doesn't have that type of soul that is so sensitive. And yet, the sages, the chazal, were sensitive to the feelings of a piece of bread. Cover it. So that it shouldn't see its shame when you're giving precedence to the wine. So in the name of covering the challah, you're embarrassing your wife in front of your children, in front of guests. Episode number 2. Not as funny as the first. Because the first is dealing with adults and the second with a child. In New York, in Flatbush, there lived a Jew. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of a yeshiva called Torah Vadas, Rabbi Avraham Palm. Stop embarrassing us. Okay. That was just a joke. Rabbi Avraham Palm related this story. A young man came to him, said, Rav Palm, I am getting married tonight. I'm going to the chuppah tonight, but I don't feel I can get married. What happened? He says, I'll tell you a story. When I was 8 years old, I grew up in a home in New York, not a rich home, struggling home, and I always craved a watch. But my birthday present, my parents bought me new shoes. They said, next year we'll buy you a watch. Couldn't wait a year. One day in school, I see that my friend got a new watch. So during recess, he had it in his coat. During recess, I went over and I stole the watch. When I came home, I put it around my wrist. I come home, my mother says, hey, wow, where did you get this watch? I said, I was given a prize in yeshiva because I was such a good boy, I received a watch. Of course, a mother smells a child's intentions or feelings. She's tell me the truth. Till he finally admitted that he stole the watch. She said, we don't do it this way. You have to return it. In the morning, I want you to go back and place the watch in the coat. We cannot take something that doesn't belong to us. He goes in the morning. He's about to take out the watch from his pocket and place it in his friend's coat. And at that moment, the teacher walks into the classroom. Halt! Stop! Somebody stole this boy's watch. His mother called me last night frantically. I want the child who has done it to admit it and confess it at this moment. The teacher was screaming and he was really scared. He could not do it. When nobody did it, the teacher says, okay, everybody sit down. I'm going to check through your pockets and your desks until I find the thief. And the teacher goes from desk to desk examining the person, the people, the children on the desks. And he knew what's coming, so he took the watch and he put it into the desk of the child in front of him.
The parents of Shnei Zalman K Could the parent of Shneur Zalman K please come to the main entrance where your child is waiting for you? Thank you.
The other child didn't know. He put it under his desk. The teacher comes, takes a look, and sees the watch there. He begins hollering at his child. Thief! Ganiv! Ganiv! And the child says, I didn't do it.
The third set of sessions should be drawing to a close, except for Rabbi Yossi Jacobson within the theatre.
Oh, wow.
The lecture will finish at 10 minutes past 3. That's Rabbi Yossi Jacobson.
That's in 10 minutes.
Lecture in the theatre will finish at 10 minutes past 3. All other lectures should be drawing to a close now. Thank you.
Not only are you a thief, he hollers, you're a liar too. For 10 minutes, the little boy is standing, and the teacher is hollering, thief, liar, liar, thief. 10 minutes. The boy behind him at this point has not the courage to confess. It was my, it wasn't him. Says Rav Pam, I'm the boy who stole the watch. I'm the one who put it in his desk. Today I'm 24 and I'm getting married tonight. When this friend of mine became bar mitzvah, 13 years old, it was a few years later. 1 year afterwards, at the age of 14, he left yeshiva. He left Judaism completely at the age of 14. Today, he loathes anything associated with Jews or Judaism. He described to Rav Pam exactly what he looks like, who he hangs out with. He has no relationship whatsoever with Yiddishkeit. And he says, I know that it's because of what happened that day in the classroom. I know that that day destroyed him from within. And I don't feel I'm allowed to get married tonight. I just feel too guilty. I never had the courage to tell this to anybody, but it was my fault. What would you tell such a young man the day of his wedding? Rav Pam says, listen, what you did was terrible. But I'll tell you the truth. You were 8 years old. There's a reason why we're bar mitzvah at 13, not at 8. You were a child, and you did something very irresponsible, something disgusting, but you were a child. Truth be told, the guilt lies with the teacher, not with you. Because first of all, even if you're sure that the child did it, is your objective to heal him from his problem, to rehabilitate him, to help him, or to destroy him? But even more important, you don't even know that he did it. A little sensitivity as an educator, a little psychological subtlety, a little empathy for another human being's inner condition. It's the teacher's responsibility. You get married tonight. Try to the best of your ability to build a relationship with your old friend and slowly try to bring him in. But you go to the chuppah tonight. And I heard the story, he told it over, to describe how the pain we can cause through verbiage resonates sometimes far deeper than other forms of pain. Judaism is a religion that sanctifies words. God created the world through words, and we can destroy the world and people's lives through words. That's the first Talmudic lesson from Tamar in the world of Remez. Then there is the next layer in the story, in the level of Drush. The question some of the rabbis ask is, why did the family of royalty in the Jewish people, and ultimately Mashiach himself, come from this relationship of Yehuda and Tamar? Why? The answer on the level of Drush, which is not the mystical answer, it's the answer on the level of Drush of expounding, of explaining, is it has something to do with the honesty that Yehuda displayed at this moment. Without being too cynical or maybe too comical, I want to depict to you the situation in different ways, in a different fashion. Yehuda was no simple anonymous person. Yehuda was the son of Jacob. He was considered the king of the tribes. He was considered the spiritual great heir of Jacob. He was the king, not only in a physical sense, in a spiritual sense, in an emotional sense. He was the leader of the brothers on many different levels. Yehuda, where the city where he lived, he was appointed to chief rabbi or chief justice of that particular city. That's why he was the one who gave the verdict that Tamar should be burnt. Now I want to ask you a question. If the chief rabbi of a country, or the chief rabbi of a community, or a city, or a continent, on his way to finding out what's happening in the stock market, sees a woman who dresses up like a harlot, and he negotiates a price with her, and he engages in a relationship, and nobody knows about it. And then finally, on her way to execution, she sends a message telling him that you are the father. What would you do if you were that chief rabbi? What would you do? The simplest thing to do was, wait. Don't kill her. A few moments ago, I was reading a sefer, and I found that Pesach Rashba in Baba Metziah that I didn't realize. And based on that, we can spare her life. I found the Rebbe Akiva Eger. I found, I found a ktsos, I found a nesivis, I found a comment in Shulchan Aruch, a Bir Agra, I found some little footnote in one of the works of Jewish law, which I forgot, and based on that, we can grant her innocence. And everything is lovely. He goes home, she goes home, he continues to be this great spiritual guru, her life is spared, and Shalom HaYisrael. Do you know what the conversation in Shul that Shabbos was after Yehuda said it was me? Do you know how many signs went up on the walls of Meir Shiara about Yehuda? Do you know what all the rabbinic organizations from the Eda Haredes to the OU had to say? Do you know? You know, when the Satmar Rav came to Israel, so if you're ever in Meir Shiara, you know how many signs there are. Every 10 minutes, new signs go up, excommunicating another dozen Jews who have just sinned a few moments ago. So the Satmar Rav walks through Meir Shiara and the walls are very old. He says, how do these walls stand? These walls should have fallen down long ago. He said, it's the glue of the signs that hold the walls up. Which was a keen observation. Do you know how many signs went up that Shabbos about Yehuda? Me, many? What do you have to do this for? Just find the Pesach Farvorfene Rashba, a Farvorfene Ritva, and that's it. Spare her life. But this is what made Yehuda the father of Mashiach. This is what made Yehuda the father of Jewish leadership. The ability to stand up at a moment of truth and say, me, many. It was me. Because you see, leaders are very, very difficult people to trust because they have power. And power corrupts. I don't know how it is in England, but I know in the United States power corrupts. Especially in Brooklyn. Power corrupts. Not because people with power are more evil than others, but they're given positions that entice corruption.
There is an extra minyan for mincha taking place now by the side of the shul. An extra minyan for mincha by the side of
what
the shul.
What time is it? Is it 3:10 already?
Thank you.
5 past. What made Yehuda the father of Jewish leadership is, I would suggest, this moment. The greatest quality a leader needs to have is the vulnerability, the ability to be honest, the ability to truly be accountable to God, to truth, and to the nation, to the people. The Talmud puts it in a fascinating way. The Talmud in Tractate Yuma asks, why did King Shaul's royalty not last? And why did King David's royalty last? King David sinned just like King Shaul sinned. However you explain their sins or transgressions on the level of these great tzaddikim. Why did Shaul lose it? And King David is the celebrated King David Malach Yisrael Chai V'Kayam till today. David, Solomon represent Malchus, royalty, aristocracy in the Jewish imagination. And the Gemara says that a parnas, a leader, which does not have a kupa shal shrotzim tluya me'achayrav, which means, literally, a box of dead insects hanging on his back, cannot last as a leader. What this means is very simple. When Moses got up to give a speech, what do you think happened? Two guys in the back, right there. Two guys in the back. You don't have to look. Sat and said, aha! Moshe is giving us Musa. Interesting. Which yeshiva did Moshe learn in? Where did he get his smicha? Where did he learn? In Valozhin? In Demir? In Brisk? Where in Toim Chetmima? Where did he get his smicha? Ah, from Paroi. He learned in the yeshiva of Paroi. That's it. Finished. David HaMelech finished a speech, fire and brimstone. The guys in the back said, tell me, David HaMelech's Baba was a Yid? She was Jewish? That's it. End of speech. Every leader had that. You know how often somebody gets up and is inspiring, and the next day in Shulah, I'm not going to tell you what his uncle used to do in Neville before the war. And I'm not going to discuss what his mother, the Grace of Tzadikas, when we were in Beis Yaakov together in the 50s. I'm not going to tell you. You know, I remember him before he was a big guy. Oh, that's it. Cut him down. This was Shaul's problem. Shaul's problem was he was perfect. His father was a tzaddik. His mother was a tzaddik. His Zayda was a tzaddik. His Baba was a tzaddik. This was Shaul's problem. Why? Because leadership is dangerous. All forms of leadership is dangerous. I don't mean only a leader of a national entity, even a leader of a family, a leader of a class, a leader of a company. What made Yehuda the father of Jewish leadership? It was the moment when at this moment of truth, instead of standing up and saying, the Rashba, he said, me many, it was on. It was that courage that showed the Ribbono Shel Olam, this family could be trusted. And hence, leadership comes from Yehuda all the way down to the leadership of Mashiach. Thank you very much.